Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. We have news that the summit with North Korea has been canceled, and so let us certainly be praying the news in that situation in terms of we would all love to see the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. We would also all love to see the day in which the people of North Korea actually lived free of tyranny. And so please lift up prayers today for
listeners, this is Ted Ross, the producer. Stand by. We have a technical issue. We'll get Carmen back on the line in just a moment, and hopefully she can continue with the show today. It'll just be a few minutes. We'll troubleshoot this and get her back online here, hopefully. Thank you for your patience as we work to get Carmen back on the air. Just a moment.
All right, I'm back. Can you hear me?
We have you. Thank you, Carmen.
I don't know what happened.
That's okay. You're back on the air. Go ahead.
All right, friends. Sorry about that. Every once in a while, the technology drops off. So I apologize for that. Let's jump into the headline news of the day. A judge in California has actually ruled that a baker, her name is Kathy, does not have to bake a cake in opposition or contradiction to her religious conscience. And so this is going to sound very much like the cake case that the Supreme Court is going to be ruling on here any day now. Actually, we're waiting for the ruling on the cake case out of Colorado. But we now have a case in Bakersfield, California, where the California judge has issued a final judgment in favor of a Christian baker who did refuse to bake a cake for a same-sex wedding. And the ruling issued says, you know, look, it's a celebration. This is celebrating an event that is a form of speech. And this individual cannot be compelled. Kathy Miller, owner of Tasty's Bakery, cannot be compelled to do something that is contrary to her religious views and convictions. The couple filed a complaint with the California Department of Fair Employment and Housing, arguing that the state's UNRRA Civil Rights Act forbids businesses from refusing to provide services on the basis of sexual orientation. And what Kathy Miller has said is, you know, look, everyone is God's creation and I love everybody, but there are certain things that violate my conscience, and my conscience is not going to allow me to participate in things that, based on scripture, I view as being, you know, wrong. And so she refused to bake the cake. They asked that the court compel her to bake. And the judge, the judge has said that indeed she cannot be compelled to bake the cake. I might drop off here again. It looks like my Wi-Fi is in and out, so just bear with us. Okay, friends. So the next story that I would like to lift up to you is actually out of Ireland. Ireland is going to take a national referendum vote tomorrow on abortion. And this is being described as a once-in-a-generation decision. I think it's more than once in a generation. We're actually talking about a reversal in Ireland in terms of protection of human life. And so we wanna encourage the Irish to continue to uphold what is the Eighth Amendment to their constitution, which was passed in 1983, which gives the unborn and the mother an equal right to life and outlaws almost all abortions, even in the cases that here in the United States would be considered you know, fairly normal practice for women seeking abortions. Ireland for centuries has been guided and certainly dominated by the Catholic Church. And so it wouldn't be a surprise that it has some of the strictest abortion bans in the developed world. But that is what the Irish are voting on, whether or not the Eighth Amendment should be stripped out of their national constitution, providing a way forward for those seeking abortions in that country. And so many different denominations and churches have called for a season of prayer and fasting as the Irish vote tomorrow on this critical question and conversation. You probably noted today's news about the NFL planning to fine teams if players don't stand for the national anthem. It reminded me that we have not discussed here on Connecting Faith the decision issued last week by the U.S. Supreme Court, which tells Congress, hey, you cannot actually prohibit any of the 50 states from authorizing betting on sports. And so sports gambling and sports betting is now possible. We're not saying that it's going to happen in all 50 states, but it is now possible in all 50 states. And it's estimated that there are $150 billion changes hands every year through illegal betting on professional and collegiate sports. And frankly, states want in on that action. So while the decision of the Supreme Court is probably the right decision in terms of the way our government is designed, we shouldn't, you know, frankly, the federal government either should make a decision or should tell the states they obviously have the freedom to make a decision. But the Supreme Court can't tell states or the Supreme Court, the Congress can't tell states they can't make a decision about something, which was the law on the books in relationship to sports betting. And so, you know, I think that from a Christian worldview, we need to recognize gambling is inherently wrong, and it results in massive regressive taxation. So Christians, you know, should not be gambling, period. And every time I read about a group of older adults returning from a church-sponsored trip to a casino, you know, but we're going to have time, I think, to discuss. I'd love you think on the subject of gambling, on the subject of betting.
Carmen? Yeah, we're having those technical issues.
I'm trying to reconnect on my technology.
Yeah, you know, I think we should maybe just go to an early break here, Carmen.
Yeah, technical issues here. Perfect.
Yeah, Carmen, let's take an early break. I'm going to ask you to go ahead and connect on the Comrex, and we'll just go with that the rest of the way. I'm Ted Ross, a producer for Connecting Faith. Carmen's going to get reconnected, and we will continue on the program in just a few minutes. Stand by, please. Come on back.
For this is what I'm glad to do.
Hey friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBerge. Sorry about our little technical difficulties. So some days this is this is the world of technology and radio. So thanks for bearing with us. So let me just complete that thought. I think that you and I need to spend a little time, set aside a little conversation time to talk about gambling and talk about sports betting and where you're at on all of that, and if you view it as, you know, contrary to the Christian worldview, and if not, you know, what's your position? Where, from whence in the scripture are you arguing for that? So we'll have to do that at a later date, because today we are continuing our conversation about immigration-related issues. And so joining me today is Matthew Sorens. He's the National Coordinator of the Evangelical Immigration Table. He's also a church resource specialist for World Relief, and he's the co-author of Welcoming the Stranger, Justice, Compassion, and Truth in the Immigration Debate. And actually, there's a revised and expanded edition of the book coming out in July, but we actually have a few copies to give away today. And so you are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge, and it's my pleasure now to welcome to the program Matthew Sorens. Matthew, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Carmen.
So, immigration is one of the most complicated, complex issues that we face. There are voices on all sides. They are all strong. They all seem to want action and change. Christians find themselves torn in the midst of these conversations. How do you feel like we can move beyond the current rhetoric to offering really an authentically Christian response?
Yeah, you know, I think because it is such a tense issue, even for Christians, and there's, you know, opinions all across the map on this topic, what I've been really passionate about is saying, let's take a step back from the political rhetoric and look at what does the Bible say, because you're not going to find an immigration policy and, you know, somehow hidden into the pages of the scripture, but the Bible has a lot to say on the topic of immigration. Many of the heroes of our Christian faith were themselves immigrants. And I know you've been looking at that all week, which is fantastic, but I think that needs to be the starting point for any real Christian conversation on this topic is how would what the Bible tells us, how does what we think God would want us to do in relation to a complex topic, how is that going to inform our both the way that we interact with our immigrant neighbors, as well as the way we think about immigration policy questions?
You know, Matthew, I think that one of the greatest challenges that we face in this conversation is how defensive sometimes we feel. And the reality is we need to be people who pursue the truth and then allow, you know, the Bible to – God through the Bible to instruct us. And if the way that we're thinking or even the way that we're feeling about something is actually contrary to what God has explicitly said – it's incumbent upon us as Christians, you know, not to continue to press our will forward, but actually, you know, come into not only submission to God's will, but then begin advocating for God's viewpoint, the kingdom viewpoint amidst the kingdoms of this world. And I know that's what you and Jenny are doing in this Welcoming the Stranger, Justice, Compassion, and Truth in the Immigration Debate book. And so we just really want to lift that up and appreciate that. What let's do this. What are some of the myths about immigration that you address in the book?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, there's a lot of myths about immigration. And I would start by saying I believed most of them, you know, not all that long ago. I mean, I grew up in a context where immigration was a political issue I heard about on television. I grew up in northeastern Wisconsin, kind of a small town. There weren't a lot of immigrants there. So most of what I knew was what I'd heard on the television on not on this radio program, but maybe on some radio programs or, you know, what gets floated around in forwarded emails. And there's just a lot of misconceptions. So I would start with the dynamic, and we talk about immigrants. Some people hear that word, and the first association is the word illegal. But it's really important to know that most immigrants in the United States have legal status. In fact, almost half are naturalized U.S. citizens. You have others who are lawful permanent residents. That means they've got their green cards. Anyone who comes in as a refugee has legal status from the date that they're admitted. So it's a mistake to think that this is only a conversation about those who are in the country unlawfully. That said, when we start to think about those who are here unlawfully, and that's probably roughly 11 million people, I think there's a lot of particular misconceptions around that population, one of which would be that they're all people who came illegally from Mexico. We actually hit the point a few years back where the majority of new unauthorized immigrants are not Mexican. Either they're Central American or they're people who are overstaying visas from Asia or the Middle East or Africa or Europe, or from Latin America. There's some, you know, who overstay visas there as well. And so they're a diverse group of people from all over the world. The slight majority of those who've been here for a long time are Mexican, but, you know, less than 60%. I think another misconception goes to the economics of all this.
So let's do the economics in just a second, but let's talk about what you just pointed out, because I actually think a lot of people don't know this. This was a surprise to my husband when he and I were talking about this week. He's like, you know, what do you mean? People are here illegally because they come across the southern border. I'm like, no, like the majority. He made me actually look up the statistics because he's like, I don't believe you, that the majority of undocumented people here in the United States, they had a document. They had a travel visa, or they had a student visa, or they had some sort of work permit for a period of time. But then when that expired, they did not leave. Is that how we should understand, you know, when you say, you know, their visa has expired, let's say. Is that how we should think about folks? They came here to school, or they came here for some other reason, and then they just didn't leave.
Yeah, that's accurate. So, and I would say when we wrote the first edition of this book 10 years ago, it was probably 55 to 60% of those unauthorized people had entered unlawfully, and the rest, you know, about half had entered lawfully and overstayed. And it's actually flipped now, where fewer of the you know, in the last 10 years, this trend has been towards more people overstaying visas and fewer people entering across the border unlawfully. And by overstaying a visa, that's exactly what you just said. It's someone who's on a student visa or on a tourist visa or any other sort of temporary visa that has an expiration date, and they didn't go back when their visa expired. And that goes to, I think, another really important misconception, which is the obvious question. What I would have always said is, well, they should have gone and signed up for a green card or signed up for citizenship. And then I started working in immigration law with World Relief and learned that a lot of what I presumed about how our immigration legal system works was based on my understanding of how my ancestors came to this country in the 1850s. And we actually have a very different system now than we did then. You don't show up at Ellis Island and say, I'd like to come and be a U.S. citizen. Ellis Island's a nice museum. I encourage everyone to go to it, but you can't go there and ask for citizenship. You can't ask for citizenship unless you've had a green card for 5 years. And the process to get a green card is very tightly limited under U.S. law. So there's certain categories of people for whom it's not that hard. For example, if you're married to a U.S. citizen and you've never been here unlawfully and you're not a criminal or a terrorist and you don't have a contagious disease, our legal counselors at World Relief can help you out. But if you don't fit in that category or you don't fit into a work-based category, which is mostly for those with very high levels of skills, like a master's degree, and you don't win a diversity lottery, which is only for people from certain countries, not including Mexico, and you are not fleeing persecution, you may be fleeing poverty or, you know, any number of other things, but not persecution that would qualify you as a refugee, you really can't apply to come lawfully to the United States. It's not that you have to wait your turn in line. There is no line. Or the more complex way to look at this is there's about 100 lines, and you don't qualify to stand at any of them.
Okay, so there's probably people listening right now. In fact, I know there are some because they've been communicating this week. You know, they have friends who are here without documentation, but they are working and they're, you know, raising their kids, and they keep asking, like, well, how can I help my friend? And unfortunately, I think what we're learning this week is that if they're already here, there's not a line for them to get in. Is that pretty much the way is that understanding accurate?
So I would say that's true at least probably 80 to 90% of the time. With that said, I always recommend to people to consult with a well-trained immigration lawyer or someone who is accredited by the U.S. Department of Justice. So many of our World Relief officers have that. We work with lots of churches that do that around the country, because it's always worth a 30-minute consultation to make sure that you're not in the kind of needle in the haystack category that might actually qualify.
Okay, but, so how do they do that? How would they send them somewhere online where they could find out the answer to that question?
So if someone was out there, they could Google Department of Justice Immigration Recognition. I know it's kind of a mouthful, but they'll find the U.S. Department of Justice maintains a roster of nonprofit organizations that are authorized to provide low-cost immigration legal advice. So again, most of our World Relief offices are that. We also work with a number of churches, but there's plenty, you know, there's Catholic Charities offices around the country that do that, various other, mostly religious groups, actually, that are providing that sort of legal assistance. So if people want to Google that, they'll see. I wish they had a convenient website, but this is the federal government, so they don't. But it's, you know, there's a list of organizations that are recognized to provide legal assistance. And they may charge a nominal fee. They may not charge anything at all. But they could help with at least that initial assessment. But to your earlier question, the sad and frustrating reality, and part of why in my work I shifted from doing those legal services directly to more of an advocacy on some of the policy questions, is in the vast majority of cases, the answer is, sorry, we can't help you. You know, it's a legal counselor will ask you 100 invasive questions and then determine that, yeah, you don't qualify under the law. It's not a question of going back and coming the legal way. You can go back to Mexico or Guatemala or Poland or wherever. You can't come back the legal way, not in 1 year, not in 5 years, not in 10 years, in most cases. So it's always worth checking to see if you're – the hard thing about this is we can't give – you know, from a legal perspective, I don't want to give say, no, none of those people would qualify, because there's a few who do, and I always want to help them discover that. But most of them won't. And that's where – how can you help your friends in that situation? First of all, be a good friend. Be there as a support. Pray for them. Stand with them. Encourage them, because, frankly, it's gotten harder in the last couple of years to be here as an undocumented immigrant. Even people who've been here 10, 20 years, there's a lot of fears that are accentuated right now. And a lot of questioning of if, you know, their neighbors who they thought were their neighbors who loved them maybe don't love them, because just some of the polarizing rhetoric. And then also being an advocate, encouraging our elected officials to say, hey, we think that we can reform our immigration laws in ways that both honor the law and say it's not, we're not condoning breaking the law by entering the country unlawfully or overstaying a visa. There ought to be some sort of a penalty for that. Although I would say I'd make an exception for a 4-year-old who was brought here as a child because they didn't choose to make that decision. But, you know, if you're an adult and you chose to enter the country unlawfully, even though it was under really tough circumstances, even though there wasn't a legal way to come, there ought to be a penalty. But in most cases, that could be a fine. That could be a, you know, a process for you to earn the chance to be lawfully in the country. And most Americans are actually very much on board with that idea, but it's been very difficult to get Congress to move forward in that direction.
Okay, so we're going to, when we come back from the break, I specifically want you to talk with us about how we can help make a difference on that particular front. Because in my conversations with people, everybody wants there to be some kind of process. And we're sort of aghast that there's not even a process. And so even if it's a restrictive process, even if it's a process that takes a long period of time, even if it's a process that's that by some people's standards is going to be, you know, horribly expensive, there still ought to be a process, some kind of process for those who, you know, let's use the 4-year-old as an example, you know, the person who was brought here as a child and has lived here really the substance of their entire educated life. And, you know, they're now a young adult, and it is completely unreasonable, not only uncharitable, but it's completely unreasonable to describe them as a non-citizen. And so how are we going to get to the place where that person can move in the direction of remaining here permanently without fear of deportation? I think that would be the, you know, that would be the heart in all of this. Like, how do we get to that place? So I want you to talk with us after the break about legislation that is happening. I'd love for you to respond to a couple of headline news stories related to immigration. None of them are going to surprise you because I know you're paying attention to all of it. I also want to let people know you can connect with Matthew on Twitter. He's at Matthew Sorens. Let me spell his last name for you. S-O-E-R-E-N-S. So it's at Matthew Sorens, S-O-E-R-E-N-S. And the book that Matthew has written with Jenny Yang, who's going to be with us tomorrow, is Welcoming the Stranger, Justice, Compassion, and Truth in the Immigration Debate. This is the revised and expanded edition. It actually does not become available until, I think, July, but we actually have some copies available for those who would call in and be interested in having a copy. So you can call us here at the studio, 877-93-FAITH, or you can email me, Carmen@myfaithradio.com. Friends, we got to take a quick break, but when we come back, I'm going to continue my conversation with Matthew Sorens about immigration, and specifically, we're going to talk about what's in front of Congress, what we can be encouraging as Christians in this conversation. So you're listening to Connecting Faith, and I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. Hey friends, welcome back. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. I'm joined this afternoon by Matthew Sorens. He serves as the U.S. Church Training Specialist for World Relief, which is the humanitarian arm of the National Association of Evangelicals. Matthew helps churches, local churches, and national denominations address issues of immigration from a distinctly biblical perspective. You can follow him on Twitter at Matthew Sorens. The book that is coming out in early July is actually a revised and expanded edition of Welcoming the Stranger, Justice, Compassion, and Truth in the Immigration Debate. His co-author, Jenny Yang, will be here with us tomorrow on Connecting Faith. And if you'd like a copy of the book, you can call me at 877-93-FAITH, or you can send me an email, carmen@myfaithradio.com. Matthew, thank you again for being with us here today and talking with us about these critically important issues. Let's jump back in where we left off, and that's with current legislation or what's going on in Congress. So we might we might see ourselves, you know, reading a headline that says, you know, here's one on the Washington Post, House GOP holds last-ditch immigration talks as showdown looms. What's going on in the House of Representatives in relationship to immigration?
Yeah, it's been a fast-moving situation in the House of Representatives, which I don't get to say very often. There's, you know, so going back to one of the categories of immigrants we talked about before the break, there's people who were brought to the U.S. as children. So it only applies to those who arrived before they're 16 years old, who were granted under the Obama administration something called deferred action. That basically means they're still not, you know, they're not given permanent legal status, but the federal government, the Department of Homeland Security, was saying these people are our last priority for deportation. We're going to focus our resources on people who are a threat. So we're going to defer action on these cases and let them have work authorization. The new administration ended or announced the end of that program last September. And so that's put pressure on Congress. And to the president's credit, President Trump has said, he said a few kind of conflicting things, but he said he wants Congress to act on behalf of those people who will be losing their work authorization and become deportable when the deferred action DACA program ends. So the House has been debating ways to do that for quite a while and really hasn't made much progress. But what's happened is a kind of a unique tool called a discharge petition, where a number of moderate Republicans and some more conservative Republicans who just feel strongly that they need a solution on this DACA dreamer situation have come on board for something called a discharge petition that, if all the Democrats join them, which is sort of expected, it actually, if they can get to 218 votes, it requires a vote on a particular bill, whether or not the House leadership calls a vote. And at this point, House leadership has not called a vote. They want to get something they think both that they can pass and the president will sign. But this is trying to kind of force the process since it's been delayed so much. So they're, I think, within probably 3 to 5 votes of signatures on this discharge petition. So if people want to see that vote, they should call their member of Congress and say, I want you to support the discharge petition for Dreamers. And they'll all know what that is because they're all hearing quite a bit about it from both directions. But that's, I think it's probably the best hope for a legislative solution around this Dreamer issue in the short term. It doesn't, I mean, that only gets you through the House if it actually passed, and then you've got to deal with the Senate, and then it would need the president's signature. So there's a few hurdles here, but at least it's positive momentum in my view.
And it's not comprehensive immigration reform. Is there some committee or group working on comprehensive immigration reform, some kind of package of laws that we could put into place that would change the current system?
I mean, there are plenty of people in the Congress who would like to see that, but realistically, I don't think it's likely to happen in the short term, in terms of the Congress. The best effort towards that was back in 2013. There was what was called the Gang of Eight, so 4 Republicans, 4 Democrats in the U.S. Senate, who basically all compromised quite a bit, and both sides took some things they didn't really want. There was a ton of resources, a ton of new money for border security, along with an earned legalization process for immigrants who were in the country and had been there for a certain amount of time and would pay a fine, and then some changes to the visa system to hopefully not get us back into this situation, 5 years from now. We supported that bill at World Relief. It wasn't perfect, but we thought it was a really positive step. It passed the Senate with more than 2/3 of the votes, and then it just went to the House of Representatives to die, and it never got a vote there. So that was like the last, I would say, good faith effort with a real possibility. And I would pray to see that come around again. But I think a lot of senators felt burned by having taken a tough vote and then it never turned into actual changes to policy. So it's made people a little bit more reserved going forward.
Okay, so let me remind people that this is Carmen LeBurge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. My conversation partner this afternoon is Matthew Sorens. He is the U.S. Training Specialist for World Relief, which means that he works on these issues all the time, and he does so from a distinctly Christian perspective and Christian worldview, and he helps churches who want to become more well-informed about immigration and immigrants and migration and refugees. He helps to equip you with information. And then if you would like to be mobilized for advocacy, he can help you on that front as well. And you can follow him on Twitter at Matthew Sorens. He's the co-author of Welcoming the Stranger, Justice, Compassion, and Truth in the Immigration Debate. A revised and expanded edition of that book is coming out in July, but we've got some copies to give away. You can call me at 877-93-FAITH, or you can email me, Carmen@myfaithradio.com. So, Matthew, there's a couple of other headlines We've been dealing with immigration headlines all week because we've been trying to sort of get our hearts and heads around this issue. And so I just, you know, it's amazing. Literally every morning, if you just Google the word immigration and click on the news feed, it's amazing how many articles every single day touch on this topic. And sometimes the information that's in the article makes me afraid, and I'm not an immigrant, and I'm, you know, I certainly not, you know. So can you help us a little bit here on this one particular headline? This is actually fairly astounding. I'm going to pull it up here from the Washington Post, although others have commented on it as well. The headline is this: Astounding Ignorance of the Law. Civil Rights Groups Slam DeVos. Here they're talking about Secretary of Education DeVos, for saying schools can report undocumented students. Can schools report undocumented students according to the U.S. Supreme Court? And let's just try to temper the fear today out there a little bit for those who are undocumented who have school-age children.
Yeah, it's a really important question. And the Supreme Court, as you alluded to, they addressed this actually a long time ago in 1982 in a case called Plyler versus Doe. It was determined that regardless of your legal status or suspected legal status, if you are in this country and you reside in a school district, you not only can but should go to elementary school and high school and through secondary education. So schools should not, and under the law, should not ask about legal status. And I would say the vast majority of school districts have no interest whatsoever in doing so. Teachers, in my experience, I wish I could say this all the time about the church, but teachers and school districts are often the best advocates for the immigrant students in their communities. They, you know, love those students and they want them to succeed. And they're very aware that if there's even a hint of a concern that there will be any sort of question regarding legal status, some parents won't send their kids to school. And then, frankly, we've seen that just when there's been immigration enforcement in particular communities, that parents are afraid and don't want to send their kids to school. But they shouldn't have to be afraid at school. And the Supreme Court ruled in on that quite a long time ago.
Okay, and then we've been talking about those who come to the United States as minors. We've talked about those who are involved in or categorized as dreamers and have they're a part of the DACA conversation. But we also have unaccompanied minor or migrant children. Talk with us about this situation and then react to President Trump's comments yesterday suggesting that these young people are not innocent.
Yeah, so an unaccompanied minor is basically anyone who shows up at the U.S.-Mexico border. I suppose it could be at the U.S.-Canada border as well, but mostly we see this from the South, who is a child, is under the age of 18, and is not accompanied by anyone, by a parent or a guardian. And in the majority of cases where we've seen this, and we've seen a significant increase in this dynamic in the last 5 years or so, probably going back to this, especially I think it was the summer of 2015, we saw a really significant increase. It's actually gone down since then. But most of these people are coming not from Mexico, although they're going through Mexico, but from Central America, especially El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. And unfortunately, those three countries, and I was in El Salvador, it's about a year ago, with a Christian group kind of learning more about the situation. They have three of the highest homicide rates in the world. And it's actually been true at various points in the last 5 years that it was less safe to be a civilian in El Salvador than in Iraq. You're more likely to be killed. And just, unfortunately, a very low level of prosecution of murders. And actually, in some ways, the worst person to be is a 16-year-old boy, because that's who the gangs are trying to recruit. And there's all these situations where someone will say, I don't want to join your gang. And they'll say, well, then we're going to kill you, or we're going to rape your sister, or we're going to, you know, whatever horrific thing might happen to you. And what we've seen is, first of all, we see a lot of families fleeing that situation. And they go not just to the U.S., but many of them seek asylum in Mexico. I was actually in Costa Rica last week. Many of them are going to Costa Rica, which is considered kind of a safe place and a little bit closer by. But many do come to the U.S. because of the reputation we have, which, you know, I think we should be proud of as a safe haven for those fleeing persecution. And our asylum laws in the United States allow those who have a well-founded fear of persecution to request asylum. So that's what we're seeing. We see it both with families, but we're also seeing it with unaccompanied minors, with, you know, 14-year-olds, 15-year-olds, in some cases 7-8-year-olds. And one dynamic that I think gets lost is some of those families have a parent already in the U.S. especially from El Salvador, because a lot of Salvadorans have something called temporary protective status. That's actually going away next year, which is a whole other story. But you have a few hundred thousand Salvadorans who were given permission to stay lawfully in the United States. Many of them had left kids behind and tried to come and work in the U.S., but that temporary protective status doesn't allow you to leave and come back. So you're kind of stuck in the U.S. So if you want to protect your kids, the best option is to, you know, the best option may seem to pay for a smuggler to bring them in. Because, again, there's no, you're not allowed to file a family petition if you are temporary protected status or if you are just undocumented as a parent in the U.S. There was a refugee program that started towards the end of the last administration to help particularly Salvadoran and Honduran and Guatemalan kids who have a U.S. citizen or lawful permanent resident parent to kind of expedite their process to get to safety. And that program's been shut down in the new administration. So there's just a lot of people facing very, very real threats of violence who don't feel like they have anywhere else to go. And in my view, and I've interacted with quite a number of these young people, the idea that they're not innocent, except for on a theological level where none of us are innocent, they're as innocent as any other kid, as any other 10-year-old or 12-year-old or 14-year-old, except for that they've been the victims of horrific violence in many cases and of threats of violence. And it just kind of breaks my heart to hear that kind of rhetoric and painting them all with this broad brush when they're the people fleeing this violence, not the ones perpetrating it.
All right, Matthew. So before we let you go, will you just speak a word of encouragement to people in churches who are listening right now and just encourage them how they can actually reach out to, befriend, and serve their immigrant neighbors?
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you asked that because it can be depressing to talk about some of the policy changes, but 95% of the work that we do at World Relief is not on policy. It's on helping empower local churches to directly serve their immigrant neighbors. And we do that both where we have local offices around the country, but we want to see that happen everywhere in the country. And we do see it happening everywhere in the country. There's there's beautiful stories of ways that immigrants are being welcomed by local churches and being mutually transformed. It's going to be a transformative experience for the local church as well. Many of these immigrants are already brothers and sisters in Christ with a lot to teach us. Others are not yet believers, and we see people coming to faith as they are loved as neighbors by the Christians in their community. So I would say the first step for most churches with that is actually a little bit of discipleship, because there really has been, I'd say, maybe a deficit of discipleship on what the Bible says on this topic of immigration. Again, I know you've had folks like Danny Carroll on and others who can speak with more scholarly expertise on that than I can, but it doesn't actually take a PhD to just read through the Bible and look at what the Bible says about, depending upon your English translation of the Bible, the foreigner in the land or the alien, the stranger, the sojourner, the immigrant. One tool we've set up at the Evangelical Immigration Table is called the I Was a Stranger Challenge. It's very simply 40 scripture passages, and you can either print out a bookmark or you can find it on the YouVersion Bible app. Search for I Was a Stranger. We've really encouraged people just to start with that. I won't tell you who to vote for. I won't talk about these policy questions, but just to start with what does the Bible say? And then encouraging pastors, this is something we need to address as a biblical issue. And then, to take the next step of how could I befriend the immigrant who's in my community? Maybe it's just on an informal basis. Maybe it's being friendly to the parent of the kid at my daughter's school. Maybe it's volunteering to welcome a refugee family or as part of an English language class or through a legal services program. We are really passionate about seeing the church love and welcome the immigrant neighbors, and we find that they're more often than not going to be blessed by those immigrant neighbors as well.
All right. Give us the website one more time.
Well, I give it to worldrelief.org for all that we do at World Relief, and then we're part of this broader network called the Evangelical Immigration Table. That is evangelicalimmigrationtable.com, and there's lots of ways partnering with the National Association of Evangelicals, the Southern Baptist Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, and various others that we can both do advocacy on policy and just a lot of learning. There's a blog there, a lot of opportunities to learn more. So worldrelief.org and evangelicalimmigrationtable.com.
All right, and folks can connect directly with Matthew on Twitter at Matthew Sorens. Matthew, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Carmen.
Hey, guys, we got to take one more quick break. When I come back, I am taking your calls on this subject. We've been talking about it all week. I want to know what you're thinking. I want to know how you're responding to the information that you're getting. I want to hear your stories. 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-93-FAITH. I'm Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. We'll be right back. Hello, friends. You You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. I am currently taking your calls on, well, on the subject of the week, which is immigration and the Christian worldview of it and what the Bible has to say about it and how we feel about all that and what we can do in response. And maybe you just have a story about how you and your church are reaching out to immigrants, how you are serving your neighbors. Maybe you are a person who is currently without documentation here in the United States. I would love to have a conversation with you. The number is 877-93-FAITH, 877-93-FAITH, and the studio lines are open. Would just love to hear what you're thinking, what you're feeling, what your experiences have been. I have an email from a listener here talking about their ministry in their church. They're in Minnesota. We have a ministry of justice and compassion through the church that that we're in, and we need help. I mean, that's basically what they're saying. You know, we need help to know how to help. We had a listener named Nancy who was on yesterday, and she was she's concerned for her friend who's been here a number of years and has three children, and faces the fear of deportation. What would the lives of her children be like if they suddenly became orphans because she was deported? And so the issues related to this are extremely complex. Nobody is denying that. I have a note from a listener saying we should take care of orphans first. Okay, absolutely, and we talk about that frequently here on Connecting Faith. We have talked with the head of the Christian Alliance for Orphans or for adoption, and you can see what they're doing at CAFO.org. There are certainly children here in the United States who need a forever home, and on any given day, there are more than enough churches in the country. If one in every three U.S. congregations would take responsibility for one child in the United States who needs a forever home, there would be no more orphans here in the United States. So, the reality of the numbers is pretty significant. People who like to argue that we don't have enough resources, we don't have enough, we don't have enough schools. The burden of immigrants, particularly immigrants who come with children. Or have children, that this is too great for us to bear. For folks who protest in that particular way, I just immediately say, are you pro-life? And most of them are. And, most of them will say, well, yeah, I'm absolutely pro-life. And I'll say, well, from a pro-life perspective, there are now 60 million people missing from the American population who have been aborted since the mid-1970s. 60 million. There would be 60 million more children in the United States. Actually, they'd now be in the generations leading all the way, some of them would be 40 by now. But we are missing 60 million people in the United States, 40 and under. And so when we talk about immigration and we talk about there not being enough resources here and there wouldn't be enough jobs, there wouldn't be enough classrooms. Well, where would the jobs in the classrooms be if those 60 million people hadn't been aborted? So, I mean, I think that as pro-life people, we can talk about human flourishing and we can talk about how God grows an economy and how God grows families. And we can look at immigrant families and we can say they place a high value on intact family systems. And so why would we want to see those family systems broken up? All right, so Vince is asking, how does Carmen feel about a wall or firm border protection? All right, Vince, I am all for secure borders, absolutely without question. And so I do think that when we talk about immigration, we're talking about a really complex set of issues. And I do think we have to figure out how to make our nation secure. I think there's no question about that. And then we do actually have really stringent processes for how people come to the United States legally. We just don't have a good way of keeping those who come illegally from doing so. And so I agree with Vince. Oh, I actually don't know what Vince's view is on this. He's just asking me what my view is. I do think we should have secure borders. I also think we should have a process. And currently, we don't have a process. And so it's a complicated mess. Matthew referred to those who came under temporary protected status. You know, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people from Central America, three Central American countries in particular, who are here in the United States, have been here, some of them, for more than two decades, so more than 20 years. So they've had kids here, they've raised their kids here, and now we're talking about, their temporary protected status is coming to an end. They're being sent back to countries that they have not now lived in for decades. And so whose fault is it that they didn't go back home? Well, we never told them what the definition of temporary was. We never said you can come, your temporary protected status is for a year, you know, while there's this chaos going on in your own country, you know, this natural disaster. And then, you know, after a year, you got to go back. We never said that. And so is it our fault, or is it the person who has been here for 20 years and we're now saying to them, oh, you know what, temporary, the definition of temporary, we don't have any idea what it was, but it's now definitely over. And so I'm concerned about the way we're treating people in the midst of all of this. Certainly, I want us to have secure borders. Certainly, I want us to be a people of law and order. I do. But right now, we don't even have, I mean, when the president says we have the worst immigration laws in the world, basically what he's saying is we don't really have any. Like, there's not a line for people to get in. You've heard that over and over this week. Where there's 100 lines and almost nobody qualifies to be in any of them. And so it is a big mess, maybe is just one way to say it. And I would like to see us work our way out of this mess. I would like to see a positive future for those who are seeking a better life, those who want their families to flourish, those who are interested in becoming naturalized citizens. The process for which, by the way, if you have not ever checked that out, the process for becoming a naturalized citizen is pretty rigorous. I'm not sure most of us native-born people would pass the naturalization exam. Most of us don't have a civics education that's anywhere up to snuff with the naturalization exam that people have to take in order to become citizens. So we just want... You know, I want to broaden the scope of our conversation. I want us to recognize that not every immigrant is here the same way. And tomorrow, maybe in our conversation with Jenny, we'll focus specifically on refugees. I think that would be one part of the conversation that we have not yet had this week. And I know it's one that is of interest to many of you based on the things you've been communicating over the course of this conversation. So as we wrap it up here today, Let me encourage you to really think through scripture stories that you already know that maybe you've never thought of as stories of migration and stories of immigrants. I was having a conversation with our kids here, and one of the stories that we love is the story of Ruth. And so in rereading Ruth, man, there's a lot of migration conversation to be had. There is, you know, fleeing famine and going to Moab, and then their family situation dramatically changes. And so when Naomi comes back to Israel, she brings a migrant, an immigrant, with her. Her name is Ruth. Friends, without Ruth, we don't get Obed. And without Obed, we don't get David. So just think about the significance of migration and immigration, even in our own faith family tree. All right, that's all the time we've got today. I'm Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. You can catch up with me via email, carmen@myfaithradio.com. And we'll be right back here tomorrow with Jenny Lang, co-author of Welcoming the Stranger, Justice, Compassion, and Truth in the Immigration Debate. And we'll also talk about the headlines of the day. Have a great day, and God bless.
Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.